from bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Right, thanks very much, Ollie Barrett. Thank you very much indeed. It's the 30th of July 2019. My name is Richie Allen. I'm live from Salford in Greater Manchester with Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. Thanks for joining me. I hope you've had a good old day yourself. Lots to talk about. Two brilliant guests. This is your show. Tweet me right now. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, I'll be joined by the stage hypnotist, one of the world's leading experts on hypnosis, hypnotherapy, NLP, and much more, Jonathan Royle, in the second hour. Jonathan presents the documentary Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, which is out in a few weeks' time. And I've already had Richard Willett on the programme from Brick in the Wall Media and one of the other contributors to this excellent documentary, of course, Neil Saunders. So Jonathan Royle joins the programme, looking forward to that. And in the first hour, Tony Gosling joins the programme, the former BBC producer, presenter, journalist, I should say, and of course the host of the politics programme at BCFM. Tony is going to run the rule over some of the biggest stories of the day. Tuesday's programme, welcome to it. Yeah, I know I said that already, I'll say it again. Welcome. Right, let's get rid of the old tune then. You will. Not too bad this afternoon. Had a bit of rain. The country apparently expecting a deluge and thunderstorms, but we haven't had any of that old nonsense in this part of Manchester yet. So there you are. We don't like the thunder, those of us that have dogs of a nervous disposition, you know. Right. Now, the police officers who are involved into investigating VIP paedophilia should be investigated themselves, according to Sir Richard Henriques. He said today, he's a former High Court judge, by the way, he said today that police wrongly claimed that Carl Beach's story was consistent when they were trying to get warrants to search the homes of suspects. So he said that's basically, they were lying. They knew Beach's story wasn't consistent, but when they went to judges to get search warrants, they lied and said Beach was a consistent witness. So Sir Richard Henriques says today a criminal investigation should surely follow. Now you know that Beach was jailed for 18 years last week for inventing false allegations of murder and child abuse. He is himself a man who has been convicted, of course, of downloading images of children, pornographic images, disgusting images. Won't dwell too much on this because you know what I think about it. So this guy, Richard Henriques, then he reviewed all of this back in 2016. And back then he condemned the Metropolitan Police. So he recommends criminal investigation and possibly criminal charges against the police. That's one to watch very closely. Okay, it's one of the bigger stories. Maybe my friend and your friend, Tony Gosling, might have a comment on that when he joins us in a minute. It's a big story. This week, you might know or you might not know, if you've had dealings with the courts and you've been in hard times or on hard times, you might know that legal aid in the UK is 70 years old this week, the programme. What is legal aid? Well, it's the provision of assistance to people who are unable to afford legal representation. Put simply, the right to be provided with legal assistance on the taxpayer if you're in a position where you can't afford a lawyer. One of the things about legal aid is, you might know this, you might not, in the tabloid press here in the UK, it's often reported upon very negatively. Like the Daily Mail, which I sometimes praise when it suits me. We all do that, don't we? It's a good newspaper when it reports the stuff that we want to be reported. But the Daily Mail often reports on it, and the Sun particularly, negatively, saying that, you know, taxpayers' money is given to convicted criminals and stuff like that. But it's a nonsense. It's very important. It's, you know, a cornerstone, I suppose, of any just society, that you're not precluded from representation just because you don't have a pot to piss in, basically, right? But for years now, it's been underfunded, austerity and all the rest of it. And now it's resulting in, well, tens and tens of thousands of people who desperately need representation can't get it. Okay, part of a wider plan and a wider agenda? Yeah, I would say so, but we won't get into that today. David Green is the Vice President of the Law Society, and he was on Sky News this morning talking about this, and I thought he spoke very well, David Green.
Well, over a number of years now, the government has been cutting legal aid, and the effect is that people are not entitled to are not able to enforce their rights in front of the court, and it's become a real problem in both civil and criminal proceedings.
The rationale for cutting access to it was a financial one, wasn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a financial argument about cutting, but in the long run, it's a fallacy that one cuts legal aid, that one can save money.
What about if lawyers took a bit less money? Would that help?
No, I mean, the concept that there are in some fashion fat cat lawyers sitting on a legal aid system is complete fallacy. There hasn't been an increase in rates for 20 years, which means there's been a very substantial cut. And legal aid lawyers are dedicated lawyers to their clients' rights.
Mm, very good. Very good answer. Very good answer, David Green. And then he kind of outlines why it's really so important, and he gives an example, maybe one you mightn't think of, you mightn't consider yourself, David Green, Vice Pres of the Law Society.
Well, being able to access the courts to enforce one's rights is an absolutely essential part of a modern democracy. And without it, the rule of law falls apart, for instance. And without the rule of law, you know, we really do have a lacking element of the modern democracy. And it's absolutely essential. You can hand out as many rights as you like to citizens, to individuals, but unless they can enforce them, they're quite meaningless. And you can take an example. I'll take an example of, let's say, a mother, two children, she's a lone mother, and she has housing problems. Maybe there's damp in her rented accommodation. She needs to be able to access the court to put that right, and she has immense difficulty doing so. One is she can't get legal aid. Secondly, is she can't find solicitors willing to take it on. We've, at the Law Society, we've made many maps of legal aid deserts where there is, the advice is simply not available. And, for instance, she may have to travel a long way to the court in order to enforce her rights. And that is simply not right in a modern society.
Of course not. But it's been decimated. And more people find themselves unable to access it now because it's been decimated. OK, we'll leave that one there. It's an important one. We've come at that before. A hi to Cocobell, who's eating a plate of chips. A woman after my own heart, girl. Eating some chips, listening to the Richie Allen Show. Hi to Patricia. Hi to Susan. How you doing, Susan? To Jason Stott, who's got the house to himself, so he's listening to the Richie Allen Show. Hi to Andy Newman. How you doing, Andy? And to everybody else tweeting today, David Stanford as well. Let me move on swiftly. The time is nearly 12 minutes past the hour. So in British Columbia, the Human Rights Tribunal has said it's going to take about 3 months to rule on this whole story, this whole case about the transgender woman, the trans woman, who wanted to have a bikini wax, but found that some of the women in British Columbia who provide that service didn't want to touch the male genitalia. This is the case of Jessica Yaniv, who's been testifying at this Human Rights Tribunal in British Columbia over the last few days. It's ended now, and the tribunal has, well, it has risen, and it's going to ponder on what to do. Yaniv says, "I was discriminated against because of my gender identity," saying that a dozen aestheticians denied waxing her meat and two veg because she is transgender. This is one of the more lunatic of the lunatic stories. Okay, one of the more loony of the more lunacy stories that we've covered. And it's important. It's obviously important in British Columbia. Do you want to hear this trans woman, Jessica Yaniv? "I could have been really mean." That's an Americanization. That's an American colloquialism. mean. I could have been mean-spirited and played a clip of Yaniv on one of those mobility scooters screaming at the press not to follow him into the lift in the courthouse. But I won't do that. Here's Jessica Yaniv explaining what's going on.
I've had to approach 16 salons.
Really sounds like a woman, huh?
Because I was refused from every single one of them. And, you know, after being refused from about five, that's when I just started saying, okay, you know what? I'm going to start recording and screenshotting these conversations. So I can see why they would be saying I'm setting them up, but that's completely not true. If this rule is not in my favor, what's going to happen is people can be denied service for literally everything and anything.
Yeah, shut up. It's very, very strange, this. Looking into it in a bit more depth today, I was able to figure out that many of these women actually work from home. So there's a safety issue, right? Many of these women who said no, their salon is based at home. Now, I know this to be true, because once a month, your presenter gets a, well, not once a month. I try to do it once a month, but it's usually once every 2 months. I get a massage on my shoulders and upper back because I have a lot of problems in that area. And the woman who does it works from home and would only do it for me, give me the massage, knowing that I do this radio show and that I'm identifiable and that I'm, you know, not likely to be threatening. It took me a while to find somebody who would do it. You know, rather than go to a clinic, I wanted to find somebody I could get to do it, say, fairly regularly. And I've had this discussion with the woman in question. And it was a personal safety issue for the women in British Columbia. No, we don't want you coming because we deal with women only. Very interesting, this particular tribunal, which has risen now, which has retired, I should say, to go and figure out what way to go with this whole Jessica Yaniv thing. We'll watch that closely. Now, Full Fact has joined, we know this because we talked about it, joined Facebook in January, Facebook's fact-checking programme. Full Fact is a charity based here in the UK. And it has recommended that Facebook should immediately extend its fact-checking programme to cover Instagram. Okay, this began in January. The program gives fact-checking organizations tools to scan Facebook for factual claims and then to mark them as true, but also to scan Facebook and find other claims and mark them as false. Okay, and if they mark something on Facebook as false, they would then provide a link to an assessment of their decision, basically. This is where it's all going, right? We've talked again about this before. Will Moy is the director of Full Fact. The director of Full Fact spoke to Sky News earlier on. When asked to explain how it all works, this is the genuine question he was asked. How does it all work, this fact-checking thing? He brings up vaccines, strangely enough.
Okay, so if you're a Facebook user, you might see something on Facebook that you don't think is reliable. There are three dots by every post on Facebook, and you can click a post to report it. One of the things, step, it is only a first step, and we know and we have told Facebook that they need to do more than this. But we've seen all kinds of misinformation, which is doing real harm. And the area we're most concerned about is health. You might know that the World Health Organization this year said that vaccine hesitancy is one of the biggest global threats to public health, i.e. people who aren't sure about whether to give vaccines or not. We are seeing online people spreading false information about vaccines again and again with either no basis in fact or based on complete misunderstandings of reliable information.
Is he talking about the women in Ireland? The women of regret? Is he talking about the mothers of girls in England who've been injured by Gardasil? Or is he just talking about any Tom, Dick or Harry who posts a link to a story about vaccines? Who's he talking about, I wonder?
And we've been able to fact check that. We've been able to say this is false.
Right, what has he been able to determine is false? Is Will Moy really, really claiming that they've been able to scour Facebook and determine that vaccine stories on Facebook or vaccine hesitancy stories on Facebook are false, because one of the most obvious vaccine hesitancy stories that comes to mind is the discussion around Gardasil and the problems that have arisen in some women who have had that vaccine. This is dangerous stuff, this, isn't it?
Here's the correct information.
Here's the correct information. All of those women in Ireland, all of those women in Denmark, all of those young women in England are lying. But here's what's interesting. My friend and colleague Jean-Anne Crowley says vaccine hesitancy is a fab phrase. It is. It sounds so harmless, doesn't it? But it isn't. Here he is in the next segment saying that people are well-meaning most of the time, he says. They're doing the best for their kids, but they're wrong. They're well-meaning, but they're wrong.
So one of the hardest things about health misinformation is that many of the people who are spreading it are actually well-intentioned. It's people who are concerned, who are trying to do the best for their children or their friends or their family. They've come across some information that might seem reliable, and they're sharing it. So we don't know exactly where these things start, but we do know that at least some of the sharing is by well-intentioned people. One of the things we need, of course, is for Facebook to be more transparent about what they know about this system and share more information with us so we can start to understand the patterns behind this.
You're one of 50 organisations taking part with them on this, but is it still the case that the onus is on the user to report something that they might think is false rather than you and other organisations and Facebook themselves looking at their platform and trying to identify it themselves?
It's a bit of both. Facebook are actively scanning and identifying content that they think might not be trustworthy with them.
Yes, we know that Facebook are actively scanning and identifying content that Facebook believes is not to be reliable. But that's not the issue, of course.
Trustworthy with their software, that's what comes in to full fact you look at. We are able to identify things through our general fact checking that should be flagged on Facebook. And as users, we can flag things ourselves.
As users, we can flag things. It's so wonderful. 2 billion people, 2 billion nearly, are using Facebook now and are glued to it, are obsessed by it. It has taken over their lives. They don't go more than 15 or 20 minutes without checking it. This is nearly 2 billion people. And now they're explaining how they're going to completely remove from Facebook that which has been deemed to be harmful to people. It's lockdown stuff, this, isn't it? 21 minutes past the hour. Let's quickly move on. No need to dwell on that one. We know what's happening there. Prince Harry. I don't know what he is. Harry Hewitt says that he'll only have 2 children with his wife, meaning he'll only have 1 more. And the reason for this is to save the planet. He also says unconscious bias is fueling racism. Where did he say this? Well, he said it in Vogue magazine because his wife guest edited Vogue magazine. And in this month's edition of the magazine, Dr. Jane Goodall, the environmentalist, interviews Harry Hewitt, interviews him and asks him questions. And during the course of the interview, which was also recorded, this guy, Harry, says, we do plan to have more children. And she says to him, only one more, hopefully. And he says, yeah, we're only going to have 1 more to save the planet. He went on to talk about unconscious bias and racism, all this social justice warrior nonsense. Right? You see where all this is coming from. So Sky News is running a climate series on the half hour most of the day, not for the first time. It's their own in-house news feature. They're running these news features all the time about plastic in the oceans and about climate change. Sky has decided that CO2 made here on Earth is driving climate, and they're laying it on thick. And their focus this week, they're doing this all the time. It isn't news, it's propaganda. Their focus is on the United States because Sky alleges that climate change will be the big issue in next year's presidential election and not the economy, stupid. Not the economy, stupid. It's going to be climate change next year in 2020. Listen to this lunatic. Some young woman who is an activist with the Sunrise Movement, and they've been occupying the halls of Congress. Proper loon.
AOC said the climate delayer is the new climate denier. And young people are fed up.
Young people are fed up.
We are fed up.
Fed up!
With the generation above us that is going full tilt towards condemning us to a future that we cannot live in. Jesus. Political parties on either side of the aisle have sold us out, and we need to see action commensurate with the scale of the problem.
Yeah, action. And again, because of the paradigm we exist in, nobody's going to say to that lunatic, who hasn't a Scooby-Doo, by the way, about climatology, meteorology, geology, hasn't a Scooby-Doo. Nobody's going to say to that plonker, you know, only 2 weeks ago, Finnish scientists, credible, accredited, qualified, peer-reviewed, and Japanese said that anthropogenic climate change is a nonsense. It's not happening. Did you know that? Nobody's going to say anything. Myron Bell was also interviewed. Do you remember him? He oversaw the Trump team's transition he oversaw the EPA transition team. That's the Environmental Protection Agency. Myron Bell. And he was interviewed by Sky as well.
There is an alternative to the global warming agenda. It's called the Trump Energy Dominance Agenda, and it is working. The United States is now the world's largest producer of oil and natural gas.
Should American energy dominance come at the expense of increasing global warming, making climate change worse, and having negative effects on public health?
Global warming is not a crisis, and it's not likely to become a crisis. The rate of warming is modest, the impacts are mild.
Which flies in the face of scientific consensus.
No, I do not believe that. I think it flies in the face of mainstream media consensus.
Yeah, and you're going to hear nothing else now. You're going to hear nout else between now and, I suppose, these people get their own way, than climate change. It's going to be the big story, the constantly running story on your national and local news channels from here until eventually these people get what they want, which, of course, is the total transformation of the human experience in ways that were, well, previously, I suppose, inconceivable to people like you and me. So there you go. Right, this is the Richie Allen Show. It's time for a tune, I think. While we get Tony Gosling on the line, it's at 25 and a half minutes past the hour. Hope you're well. Hope you're in good shape this Tuesday. Terrific Motown. This is the Four Tops and Reach Out. I'll be there on your Richie Allen Show. Welcome to it. Reach Out, I'll be there from the Four Tops and the Richie Allen Show. 27 minutes past the hour. Tuesday's programme. Lots of tweets on the vaccine thing. Samantha says, yeah, we're all doing our best for our children by not giving them this toxic crap. He's a proper F-wit, says Samantha, referring there to Will Moy from Full Fact. Let's welcome back to the programme, great friend of ours, brilliant journalist, the host of the Politics Show on BCFM in Bristol, which is unmissable, and also a veritable authority on Bilderberg. Check out bilderberg.org, thisweek.org.co.uk. Former BBC journalist Tony Gosling, welcome back to the programme. Thanks for gracing us with your presence. What sort of a summer are you having, T?
Thank you for your confidence in me, which is not shared by our mayor in Bristol, Marvin Rees, so-called Labour, who simply won't come on the programme. And I guess that maybe that's because he just thinks I'm a bad journalist. But it also, of course, it was pointed out on our programme last week that maybe it's just he doesn't like awkward questions. And, you know, weirdly, you just talking about vaccines, that was just the word I'd just written down, because I've done a little... Well, it's a very, very basic. It's just a couple of lines about just some real, real simple basic advice on vaccines. And that is, I don't think we should be totally against them, you know, 100%. But one of the basic things is if your doctor is telling you your child needs a vaccine or you need a vaccine, and then they're saying, well, we're going to need to combine this vaccine with a whole load of other things because this vaccine is so good and these other ones are so good that we're going to inject you with five or six vaccines all at once, there's just one thing to say to them: Gulf War Syndrome. And this is one of the things that caused Gulf War Syndrome. Certainly that was the opinion of the people who suffered because of it. Obviously some died, but those that survived Gulf War Syndrome back in the 1990s were absolutely adamant that it was because they were being injected with something like 6 or 7 or 8, 9 or 10 different things all at once. And their body, basically their immune system broke down. Their body couldn't cope. And the same is true, of course, for an infant, a baby. So at the very least, I mean, this is nobody can really argue with this, Richie, is you say, well, I'm happy to have one vaccine, or I'm happy for you to give my child a vaccine, but don't you dare think about combining it with loads of other things. Well, give them one at a time. Let's, you know, let's not rush it, and let's not overload their ability to deal with these things. I mean, generally speaking, I'm anti. You know, I don't really think vaccines are a good idea unless you're going into a specific area and the vaccine is a good vaccine and it's a single vaccine. But, I mean, we're being bamboozled on a massive scale here, and we're being gaslighted as well, of course, by the BBC and the rest of them, saying, oh, you people are anti-vaxxers, you know, you're just vaccine deniers. And the actual truth is that we do need a proper public debate about this, which there simply hasn't been, because the drug companies, GlaxoSmithKline, Merck and the rest of them, have been lobbying so hard to get these vaccines as mandatory. And that's the horrific. I mean, this is what they're doing now in Germany, is they're saying if you don't get your kids vaccinated with this stuff, well, you're going to be fined and potentially jailed. So whose kids are they, by the way? Are they the state's property, or are they, you know, the loving parents that brought them into the world?
That's a whole other programme, that. We might get into that sometime on the programme. No, seriously, because that's a huge issue, that. Because we're seeing a steady encroaching on the rights of the family and the rights of parents to parent their children. I'm fascinated. See, I love having you on, Tone, because you never know where the conversation's going to go. It segues off into different areas. I'm fascinated by what's happened in Birmingham. I'm fascinated by what's happening in Birmingham. There you have parents. You know, it's amazing. The enemy of mine, enemy is my friend. You've got conservative Christians who would have despised Muslims. Well, not despised them, but would have had nothing in common with them. Kind of coming together to say, look, whatever, leave terms like homophobia to one side. Leave all that nonsense to one side. We think the kids are too young at 4 to be asked to comprehend what are very, you know, serious issues, seriously personal issues, like their sexuality, like their gender identity. Leave them alone. And yet you've got the Minister for Education, it's changed, it's Gavin Williamson now, right? You've got these people, you've got even Priti Patel has been speaking about this, saying, no, the state has decided that children must be told that this is good, this is good, this is good. And to hell with what the parents think. What do you think of that story? I think it's a big story, that.
It is. Yeah, of course, I think you should be definitely leaving this out of the curriculum for kids. They don't need to be taught about what is not normal sexuality. And I don't think they even really need to be taught about what is normal sexuality. Absolutely. Either at that age. Let's just leave the kids until they develop their own sexuality to do that. And what they're trying to do, of course, with this is to normalize what for not just centuries, but for hundreds of tens of thousands of years have been right across all the different faiths, right across the world, marriage has been between one person of one sex and one person of another sex. The idea that you can use the BBC and the secular government to change all that, to legislate, to say that marriage is no longer between one sex and the opposite sex, but it's between the same sexes, to me is laughable, Richie. And the idea that you can try and then tell infant school children, 6, 7, even younger, that this is normal when it's not, is just, to me, is preposterous. And I think most people listening to these debates will see the idiocy of it.
Yeah, I was tweeted by somebody who took offence at something I'd said, and it was a parent, actually, of a gay teenage kid, and sent me a tweet, and then blocked me, which I was really annoyed by, because I'm like, well, good that you tweeted me. You know, and you can come on the programme and you can have a right good go at me because I've got thick skin and I'm not a bully. So you can come on. But tweeted at me saying, you know, it was hateful, and what if you had a son or a daughter? And my response was, the only time the school should intervene is if they see that there is clear discrimination, clear bullying or tormenting. So if you've got a child, you know, who's a bit effeminate, or a child who might be saying, you know, well, I think I might be gay or whatever like that. And then you've got other children interfering in that. That's when the school should get involved. Only then, and say to the antagonising child, listen, none of your business. We don't do that.
You probably remember the document Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars.
Oh, yes.
which was touted around. I mean, you know, it's difficult to know the veracity of it, but what it was saying was pretty clear, is that we need to engage all women who have been, up until the 1960s when it was came out, or early 70s, mostly housewives. We need to get them all into work. Number one, because then they start having to pay tax, because when they're working at home, doing, you know, looking after the kids, etc., that's not being, it's not paid work and it's not tax work and it doesn't go into the GDP. But the other thing is that if we can persuade all these women to go out to work, then we can prize their children off them and start to educate them in big inverted commas and indoctrinate them the way we want to. Now, you know, you imagine how education very first started, you know, back in the Industrial Revolution, mainly around about that time, with, you know, formal schools being set up. And it took a lot of effort, actually, to prize the children off the parents and say, well, it's okay, you can give them a good Christian education, we'll bring them up in a very moral way. And eventually, slowly, after 100 years or so, parents got used to letting their kids go to school. And they trusted the people that were teaching them those values. But what's happened since, of course, is now everyone's got used to just giving up their kids to go to school and trusting the system, is that the state is now starting to intervene and saying, right, well, we want to program our young people to behave like this and to be like this. And I just think that over the years, it's a centuries-long project, Richie, that's prized the kids away from the parents. And the idea is that we want to press a few buttons, change a few policies, Michael Gove or whoever it happens to be, and program the kids up to be the way that we want them rather than the way the parents would.
Yeah. Yeah, hugely important issue that, again, we could do a whole programme on it. Tony Gosling is our guest, thisweek.org.uk, the host of the politics show at BCFM in Bristol. It is an outstanding programme, folks. I know many of you who listen to this programme are well aware of Tony and who he is.
Martin Summers is outstanding, Richie. I mean, he's extremely good. He's a former aid worker, worked in Bosnia. He's worked for Amnesty, worked for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development, doing all sorts of dirty tricks for them. And you might want to get him on to talk about that sometime. But Martin and I, yeah, we have a go each week, really, at you know, we also obviously with guests and well and live clips in trying to get to the facts. And I've just literally heard this morning, I mean, the big thing that's going on at the moment, of course, is this tanker war. And the question is, what is Boris going to be doing? Because this is really the legacy that Jeremy Hunt has left for Boris. And it's probably, the reason why Hunt was not included in Boris's new cabinet is because he's left in this awful problem of the seized tanker in Gibraltar. And the captain has come out the last day or so and explained, and I don't know if you covered this, Richie, that the legislation in Gibraltar was changed literally the day before the tanker was seized.
No way. No, I didn't know this. I didn't know this, Tony. Tell all. I didn't know. I have read today.
Unbelievable, isn't it? So they're saying in Gibraltar, oh, this is not a political act. We were just doing it because this tanker just happened to have violated the EU. Now, the EU sanctions, well, the EU don't care about the sanctions. The sanctions were to do with Syria from about 5-6 years ago, which was in a civil war. Well, wasn't real civil war, but that's at least, you know, there was massive fighting going on right across Syria. Most of that has now been cleared up with the help of the Russians, Iranians and everybody else that's intervened there. And so this is really history. I mean, it's this sanctions regime doesn't really apply anymore because there's no... there's no need to have them, but they changed the laws in Gibraltar the day before to allow for this tanker seizure, which, by the way, was in international waters. And the captain has been spilling all, saying, well, these guys came onto my ship, they didn't even speak to me, they just basically elbowed me off the bridge, pointed guns in my face, and they wouldn't answer any questions, and then they steered the ship. And I think this shows to me that the Marines that did it knew that what they were doing was piracy. They just then simply steered the ship from international waters into Gibraltar waters, and that's where it was held. And of course, we've seen since that the Iranians have done a rather masterful move back, seizing a British ship and saying, well, you know, you can grab one of our ships, so we can grab one of yours. Where do you want this to end?
Yeah, but where might it end? You see, obviously, you'd be mad to surmise or to speculate any sort of ground invasion. That's not going to happen. But a bombing campaign against Iranian targets, a protracted one maybe, that's something that might happen. And I wouldn't imagine, and I'm certainly no military expert, far from it, but I wouldn't imagine that the Iranian government would take that lying down, and I would imagine that they would retaliate, and maybe retaliate against Israel. And where that ends, well, that ends in a world war, doesn't it?
Well, it also ends in, amazingly, and it sounds strange to say, but a victory for Netanyahu, because apparently this is one of the things he wants. He wants to have this sort of conflict so he can then be the strong guy, he can have political capital out of it, and he can be seen to be putting down these the Persian hordes. The irony, of course, being that thousands of years ago, it was actually Cyrus the Persian that charged across to Babylon and released the Jews from their captivity in Babylon. So this is the way they pay them back, is to try and start World War III, you know, with them. But also, of course, the big force in there is the Russians, and they're a major force, and the Chinese have backed to a certain extent the Iranians, but Russia is almost 100% backing them. And but domestically, what's going on, I think, has been fascinating over the last couple of days. This pillorying by Putin of Alexei Navalny's party over in Moscow. Now, Navalny's a really interesting character. I mean, he tweeted just last year, just before there was a horrendous, after the elections in Russia, there was a horrendous attack, or no, it wasn't an attack, it was a fire at a shopping centre in Kemerovo, in March last year. And just literally just a few days before that, Navalny had tweeted, after these elections, keep a close eye on Kemerovo. You know, so was he involved in some sort? Did he know something that was going to happen there? Everyone afterwards said, well, I remember Navalny tweeting about that. The other thing about him is a lot of people have pointed to him as someone who's not necessarily taking money directly from the West to, in order to try and create some sort of Western-sponsored opposition party to Putin. But he, what he's doing is he's using the tactics that have been used in Ukraine and other places. In fact, it's a NATO playbook, basically, where, you know, what you're doing is you're pointing out specific things of corruption that are going on, which is fair enough, absolutely fine. But the thing is, you're taking your whole strategy and your backing from the West. I mean, we've got all these oligarchs that were tried to rape Russia in the 1990s. You know, there's Kolomoisky.
Succeeded.
Kolomoisky. Kolomoisky's now sponsoring, what's his name, Volodymyr Bolensky in Russia. He's backed by one of these oligarchs that failed in their, well, they, to a certain extent, they made a lot of money, but then Putin kicked them out. So there's this whole, by taking over Russia in 2000 and in the early 2000s, Putin then got rid of most of these oligarchs who had been grabbing all of the infrastructure of Russia for virtually nothing. And they were trained up to do that, by the way, in Switzerland. And as these people got kicked out of Russia, so one by one, they started to be a big thorn in the side of Putin. And they're the sort of people who are helping and sponsoring people like Navalny. So if you've got outside forces helping an opposition party, you've got foreign powers intervening to try and control the politics of Russia. Well, of course, the authorities in Russia are absolutely right to stop that kind of activity of that kind of political party. And I'm surprised he doesn't just simply close that down, because there are much better legitimate criticisms, mostly actually by the old Communist Party, of Putin, of corruption. And Navalny, it looks to me almost certain, as a, you know, someone who's very much associated with Yale University and the Otpor, that he's one of these people who's Western-sponsored rather than a real domestic opposition. And I could totally understand Putin and the Russian establishment saying, well, we just simply cannot allow foreign powers to be organising an uprising in Moscow. But if you go to it's a very different story over in Hong Kong, because that, to me, looks very much domestically run and domestically led, because, you know, you're getting literally millions of people in Hong Kong out on the streets, which Navalny simply can't do.
Yeah, this is really interesting, Tony. Again, we could go into that in even greater depth and be at it for a while. But I want to just stay with Israel, Iran, Russia and Corbyn. Just a couple of quick points before you jump back in again. I'm very interested in the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu visits with Vladimir Putin fairly regularly. From what I can understand, as often as once every 5 or 6 weeks or once every couple of months. And no minutes are taken. No, there's no briefing on what they discuss. This is true. A number of sources have endorsed this. So I want to get your thoughts on that. Before that, though, my feeling is that a lot of the anti-Semitism nonsense around the Labour Party is driven by a belief that if Jeremy Corbyn was leading a Labour government or a coalition government, that he would be some obstacle or some barrier to an assault on Iran, an aerial bombardment of Iran. I'm not saying that it's true. I'm not saying that Corbyn would be a genuine barrier. I mean, you know from talking to me a lot over the years that I don't regard or rate Jeremy Corbyn at all. I have no time for him. But I wonder how much of the anti-Semitism stuff, looking at Alistair Campbell on Sky News today talking to Kay Burley from a very wealthy home in Marseille, speaking of mass murderers and lawyers, talking about Corbyn, how much of it is driven by this feeling amongst the neocon Zionists that Corbyn would be some sort of barrier to what they plan for Iran? What do you think?
Well, look, first question, with Putin and Netanyahu
regularly,
you keep your friends close and your enemies closer, don't you? So he realises that the relationship between Russia and Israel is absolutely key to, you know, Russia is treading on eggshells as the Russian armed forces intervene in Syria. So that's one of the reasons I think that Putin is quite rightly saying, well, we need to make sure that our relationship with Israel is absolutely as close as possible, because potentially we might have to go to war with them. And that doesn't mean to say, you know, he's a very mature politician, I think. He's not the sort of person, well, I don't like this country, like the West seem to do. You know, we don't like this country, let's put them in a box marked trouble and just be nasty to them. You know, Putin's doing that, and he realises, I think, he's got to have a good relationship with Netanyahu just in case war breaks out. With Corbyn, I think, I don't look, I mean, we do disagree on him to a certain extent. I don't necessarily think his whole programme saying I don't believe in Brexit anymore, which he seems to have slowly been had his arm twisted round by the rest of the parliamentary party to do, is even genuine, Richie. I think he could even simply be waiting for the Conservative Party to make a massive mess of Brexit in order to gain political capital out of it. I wouldn't say that's necessarily a bad tactic, because he may then win a general election on the back of it. So you can see why he might be doing that. But he's definitely genuine about Palestine. He's one of those people that really does understand the injustice that's been done to the Palestinian people. And I don't think it's going to be possible to really get Corbyn to be a pro-Netanyahu, pro-Likud, pro-Israel supporter, you know, or a friend of Israel. But I had an interview with a guy called Anton Chaykin a couple of weeks ago, and he was a great guy. I wasn't even sure he was still alive, but he is. And he's the son of the Jacob Chaykin, who was the strategist and the lawyer for the Nazi boycott in the United States, the Jewish boycott in the US of Nazi Germany in the World War II. And Anton Chaykin was saying to me, I mean, this is amazing, really. He's comparing what's going on in the Labour Party to what was going on in the Jewish community in the United States, because there were very, very powerful Jews who were funded by Kuhnlohe Bank to be pro-Nazi. And they were making a big fuss about how wonderful Hitler was and how useful he was at stopping the Bolsheviks, blah, blah. And he said most of the Jews obviously realised what Hitler was up to. This is way back in 1933 when Hitler was first elected. They organised a boycott against Nazi Germany. He was elected, wasn't he? This is before, and Anton pointed out, this is before Hitler got any power and arms and an army or anything. This other Jewish faction, led by Kuhnlohe Bank, they overturned the boycott. They broke the boycott. And he was comparing what's going on with Corbyn now to those situations then, where you've got different factions within the Jewish community, that is Zionist factions, or, you know, I would call them the sort of learned Jews from Europe over the centuries, who just picked up much brilliant independent-minded stuff from not only from their own faith but from their interaction with the local community, with from government, etc., from just having their own community and their own independent minds, they decided that they had to, you know, draw a line when Hitler was brought to power. But that was undermined by other Jews who were more interested in the money. And he was comparing that to today, which I think is a brilliant comparison to make, and something I haven't seen anyone on the BBC even really acknowledge, that there's a strong Jewish faction in Britain, which there certainly is in Bristol. Many of the Jews I speak to in Bristol are, you know, disgusted to see the way that Corbyn has been being smeared.
But Corbyn is doing nothing for himself, Tony. You see, this, we keep coming back to this, and I do with other guests as well. Here you have a guy who did an interview with Sophie Ridge for Sky News last week. I think it aired on Sunday morning. And Ridge presents him with an open goal. She asks him about the Panorama feature about anti-Semitism. And Corbyn knows that Panorama used people who allegedly worked for the Labour Party to denounce him and his closest aides as interfering in, you know, having interfered in cases of anti-Semitism. They denounced them. Some of them made unsubstantiated claims that they were abused and ridiculed and called names. And only two of them turned out to have been featured in the Al Jazeera show, The Lobby, which unmasked Joan Ryan taking bribes from an Israeli embassy staffer. And in that lobby,
Shai Massa. The political attaché.
So Corbyn is sitting there,
kicked out of the country.
Yes, and Corbyn is sitting there, and he knows that some of the people that the BBC put on camera, in front of the camera, on their Panorama show, he knows that they were intimately connected to the Israeli embassy and to the attempt to undermine anti-Israeli or pro-Palestinian politicians, and Corbyn just sits there. Corbyn is not going to do anything. We'll never leave the European Union because the elites will never allow that. Corbyn is genuinely anti-European Union to his bone, but is never going to say it ever again. He's completely hijacking. I think Gilad Atzmon has written some amazing stuff on what's happened to Corbyn. Corbyn is a non-entity. Well, he's right, though. It's shocking to see that,
yes,
right?
To a certain extent, yes, he is. But the thing is with Corbyn, I think he's trying to please everybody, which is almost an impossible thing to do. It's like he's in a situation where he should have realised, you know, give him an inch, they'll take a mile. But we ought to talk about the Carl Beach thing as well, because this is enormous, isn't it, too?
Well, it's enormous, right? Look, Harvey Proctor has been on every television channel today saying that...
Yeah, the convicted sex offender Harvey Proctor.
The convicted sex offender, that's right.
Underneath his name, you know, underneath convicted sex offender Harvey Proctor... Every time he appears, those words should be with his name.
Now, hang on, he would argue that he had consensual sex with 17-year-olds when the age of consent was 21. He would say it wasn't fair. You shouldn't consider me a sex offender, he would say.
Yes, but those people that testified against him said that he was a sadist, that he got all this sexual pleasure out of beating young boys. I mean, this was all part of the case which he was convicted. So yeah. We can't just brush that under the carpet. So the Carl Beach thing, really, to me, is pretty horrific looking at it. It's one of the undisputable aspects of it is it's bound to have a chilling effect both on the police and on survivors of child sexual abuse,
yes.
Which is not really what you'd expect any decent government or decent inquiry or decent police force or decent press would want to happen. So, you know, I mean, the idea that this guy, he's being talked about as starting a witch hunt. Well, I wonder whether the witch hunt isn't also for him. I mean, the guy's clearly been involved in his younger years in difficult circumstances of one sort or another. We can't necessarily say what and what not, because clearly he was to a certain extent a fantasist. But certainly, look, Richie, the guy's psychologically damaged. And I would look at it as a kind of MK Ultra style manipulation that's been done of him. A vulnerable guy, basically. And we on our program said this exactly 2 or 3 years ago, that he's vulnerable. You can't necessarily trust everything he said, but at that point they were believing and trusting, the police were, and the authorities, everything. And we said at the time, this looks to us as if he's being set up. He's been set up as a patsy. That was 2 or 3 years ago we said that. Now he's due to do 18 years in prison. Okay, remember Theresa May, it's her child sex abuse inquiry she set up that's led to this, really, and all the publicity and the civil service around it. Lyle Goddard, who was one of the best potential chairs of that committee, had to resign because she could not choose her staff. The staff were being given to her, forced on her by the Home Office, which was itself under investigation for facilitating child sexual abuse. And so she said, well, how on earth am I supposed to work with staff who are actually the suspects in this inquiry? And she quite rightly went. But the inquiry has gone on ever since with the lady from Rotherham, Alexis Jay, who actually got nothing done in Rotherham apart from had a big hoo-ha, but nobody was prosecuted. None of the police were prosecuted. None of the social workers were prosecuted. None of the local authority officials were prosecuted in Rotherham. So she seems like the perfect person for a whitewash. And if you compare the 18 years in jail that Carl Beach is having to do, he was called Nick, wasn't he?
Yeah, Nick.
You know, look, there was a fascinating case just a couple of weeks ago of Youssef Mackey. You may remember in Manchester, a grammar school pupil who was stabbed in the heart and murdered. Well, apparently not murdered. And he's 17 years old in Hale Barnes.
Hale Barnes, yeah.
Posh part of Manchester.
Very posh, yeah.
By a 17-year-old boy who is just only known as Boy A. He successfully argued that I stabbed him in the heart in self-defense, where this guy apparently had pushed him. And the three kids, the 17-year-olds, had planned to rob a drug dealer, and that never worked out.
But of course, this is
all the testimony from Boy A and Boy B, these 17-year-olds that can't even be named. Not only that, the guy Boy A, after this verdict, saying he wasn't guilty of murder and wasn't guilty of manslaughter, he released a stabbing motion video. So it's a motion of himself doing a stabbing action with his hand, which was then circulated to the victim's family. And he's going to do a maximum of 8 months if he is on good behaviour, and then he'll be released. And he didn't murder anybody. He didn't. There's no manslaughter. So compare this with Carl Beach. Here's someone who's come forward, who's vulnerable, and he's talked about being sexually abused. Well, maybe he's, you know, said the wrong thing. Maybe he's been encouraged to say the wrong thing. Maybe he's been manipulated. He has to go to jail for 18 years as a whistleblower for child sexual abuse. Oh, but a so-called non-murderer gets 8 months. And no wonder the father of Youssef Mackey, who died back in May, I think it was this year, is angry, because there's no justice in these sorts of decisions whatsoever, Richie.
He was, he's quite rightly outraged. And there's, you know, a lot of people in this part of the world who believe that the family status and money and contacts and connections have basically left him, you know, I would say, basically get away with it. Just finally, because he's got about 2 minutes left, we're approaching the top of the hour. Tony Gosling, thisweek.org.uk, the politics show on BCFM. Finally on Beach, the logical conclusion is, you've said it yourself there, that mud was thrown at some innocent people, at some not so quite innocent people, but not monsters either, maybe, not to muddy the waters, but to give the public the impression that it's all nonsense when we know it isn't, but also to dissuade police officers and detectives from following it up in the future. I mean, Richard Henriquez has come out today and said that there should be a criminal investigation and some of these detectives should face criminal charges. So basically warn people to stay away from it and get the public thinking that it's all nonsense.
Well, the justice system has been bought. That's what's happened, I think, because money has been thrown at lawyers on behalf of Harvey Proctor and various other people in order to make an example of Carl Beach and to send a very, very clear message. Because, of course, the clear message that was sent out after the Jimmy Savile scandal, which itself, there was a massive attempt to cover that up initially, and it was only the Oldie magazine that published an article about it. Nobody else would publish, not Private Eye and Ian Hislop and that lot. They said, no, we're not interested in this story. Biggest story of the decade, and so there was a massive message went out to the police and to the public that we're going to start taking child sexual abuse seriously. What's happened with this Carl Beach case and Harvey Proctor going on the TV saying, look, I've won, is the total opposite effect. It means that those who are whistleblowers, potential whistleblowers, people who've been abused, survivors, are going to be thinking, God, I don't want to end up with 18 years in jail. I better shut up. I better not go to the police. And the same sort of thing with police. And And remember Gordon Anglesey, I don't know if you remember him, from North Wales. He was the guy who was, he got loads of, I think it was £250,000-£300,000 in compensation from the newspapers, said that they'd smeared him, that he was a paedophile, and all the papers had to apologise, and he got a massive payout, and everyone was talking about him as the victim. It turned out he really was a paedophile, and he had to go to jail afterwards, and he died after, I think it was like 3 weeks in jail. So the Gordon Anglesey case should teach us that perhaps Harvey Proctor may have won this case, but it may not absolutely and ultimately guarantee that the truth of that case, and the and also the, you know, Carl Beach may appeal, and it may turn out that some of the people that he was making allegations against were paedophiles. So one law, one legal case may send out a massive message in order to stifle debate, stifle for people from coming forward, but that may only last for a certain amount of time, as in the case of Gordon Anglesey, Richie.
Brilliant, Tony. We could have spoken about Jeffrey Epstein, but we'll get into that another time. We're watching that closely as well. Listen, always great to have you on, folks. Thisweek.org.uk. If you haven't before, I know you have, but if you haven't, check out Tony's programme. There's not very much like it, to be honest, on the radio in this country today. Thanks, mate, for your help, as always. I know we'll be doing this again real soon. Cheers, T.
Cheers, Richie, and God bless to all your listeners.
You too, mate. The brilliant Tony Gosling, live on the line from Bristol this afternoon. Thisweek.org.uk is the website there. It's just after 6 o'clock. It is Tuesday, July 30th, 2019. This is the Richie Allen Show, live, of course, from Salford in Greater Manchester. From Salford in Greater Manchester. There's nothing like it, this dirty old town. Have a listen to this for a couple of seconds. Back in a minute with some music. And then Jonathan Royal is going to join the programme. I can't wait to talk to Jonathan.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
All righty, right. Jonathan Royal should be standing by. I'll get him on. I'll read some of your comments as well in a couple of minutes. It's your Richie Allen Show. It is broadcasting live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, my own website, and the TuneIn app as well. Download the TuneIn app. And the programme is archived on Spotify. It's archived on iTunes, Podomatic.com, and the Truth Seeker app. Do download the Truth Seeker app. This is the Eagles and One of These Nights on your Richie Allen Show. Back in two. Yeah, the Eagles and One of These Nights on the Richie Allen Show. Paul Burchill says, Richie on Twitter, that song turned me to the Beatles, to the Eagles. Oh, Jesus. Oh, just read Twitter, Richie. Just read the Twitter. Read the tweet. The songs that turned him on to the Eagles. How you doing, Paul? Hi to Ricky Emmett as well. Hi to Busy on Twitter. Nice to hear from you, Busy there. To Patrick Vidian, to Charisse, to Susan. David Stanford as well tweeting there about the conversation that I was having with Tony Gosling. Now, a couple of weeks ago, or maybe 3 weeks ago, time flies and you're having fun, I had Richard Willett, who's one half of the team behind a brand new documentary film which will be out in a few weeks' time. Danny Cotton is another filmmaker. But we had Richard on and Neil Sanders. Neil, of course, regular guest, contributed to this brand new documentary film, which is very important. It's called Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. It's a feature-length film, and it deals with how we, you and me and everybody else, are being manipulated, and how our thoughts are being invaded and controlled and hypnotized on a daily basis. And the man who presents this documentary is somebody I've heard quite a bit about of late. His name is Jonathan Royal. Jonathan is a very well-known and acclaimed hypnotherapist and stage hypnosis performer. Magic mentalism, neuro-linguistic programming, he's an expert in that. Very interesting and very funny guy, and he's fronted this documentary. I'll give you all the websites as we go along. Delighted to welcome to the programme Jonathan Royal. Jonathan, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Do you know what? I think it's a bit overdue, actually, because I'm not on Facebook anymore, but my mate Raj, who is real, it's not one of these BBC creations, you know, Raj, has said to me of late that he follows you on Facebook, and he's been saying, oh, you've got to get this guy on on your programme. So it's about time that you've come on, Jonathan. And first of all, congratulations on doing the film. And I guess you're pretty excited, Jonathan, about it coming out in a few weeks.
I certainly am. As the first week of September rapidly approaches, which is when it's going to be released on all the various video on demand platforms, I'm excited and a bit apprehensive as well, just a little bit. And the reason for the apprehension, it's not, as you might think, a fear of how people will accept it or register it when they see the documentary, because to be honest, I'm already prepared for the fact that there will be a group of people who think he's lost the plot and what we're talking about. A bit too way out there. Then there'll be a whole bunch of people who are already believers. It's the midsection that I'm kind of more apprehensive about, because my whole, if you like, ethos, aim, desire for this documentary, when I was speaking with Brick in the Wall Media and Richard Willett and Danny Cotton, is that I believe that the key to all the things that people call conspiracy theories, and the only reason I ever use that phrase, conspiracy theory, is because we know it is a general term that covers the things that, the stuff going on behind the scenes. The trouble is, it was thrown out there by the CIA to try and make people who dig for the truth look like nutters. But so I'm only using it as an umbrella term that in this documentary, we're going to look at pretty much every area of what people think of as conspiracy theories, and show that the underlying key thing of them all, where there is evidence, obviously, of these things taking place, but the key thing that connects them and why people get away with them for so long is because of what could be called brainwashing, mind control, psychological manipulation, or group social conditioning and engineering techniques of the mass populace, so that they psychologically click into a state of cognitive dissonance, which in a nutshell means that deep down, I believe the majority of people out there actually know that the powers that be, sometimes the term Illuminati gets thrown around by people, but the people that want the power, the riches that are at the top of the tree, they know deep down, I think, the mass populace, that there's something not right. But they probably deep down know that most of these things they hear about and then fob off as conspiracy theories so they can laugh about them are actually based in fact and truth quite often.
Right, so that's like a coping mechanism in terms of coping with not being able to cope, Jonathan. This is fascinating to me. The coping mechanism,
if they
accept
fully, consciously, the fact that things that get dubbed as being conspiracy theories by the powers that be so that they can fob them off, if they were to go, well, no, hang on a minute, I think that they're conspiracy facts, and were to go and do a bit of digging, and they would find then that quite often, not every time, but quite often, things have got factual basis. But then they would have to face up to the fact that what they thought as reality was largely a whole pack of lies that lots of areas of the life have been built upon from birth. And that's a very uncomfortable, bitter pill for people to swallow. It is like Morpheus, it's literally like Morpheus in The Matrix. Which pill do you want? And if you take a certain one, there's no turning back. So people who start to dig a little bit start to find some factual basis to what gets termed conspiracy theories, kind of give up more often than not when they find that the rabbit hole starts to go deeper, because it's damn scary, the idea that, oh, could I have been brainwashed, manipulated and lied to by the powers of be from the very first day that I was born? And also there's a psychological pain connected to it as well. The system's been structured to indoctrinate you. You mentioned this earlier, the education system. It's not to teach you stuff. It's to get you to learn things, remember them and recall them when you do exams, so that you get rewarded and then feel good by having recalled what the authority figure taught you. It's a training ground to get you to obey authority figures.
To accept the system. To accept the system, Jonathan. Now, can we take it? Can we take it one step further, Jonathan Ryle? Mm. Jonathan, hypnotherapist, stage hypnotist, comedian, researcher, fronting this really exciting new documentary film by Brick in the Wall Media called Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, which is out in early September, and I urge you when it comes out to support it and watch it. Jonathan, you take it. Could I take it one step further? And that fear of coming to terms with that you were lied to and that you were brainwashed, maybe the fear goes one step further. Maybe people are scared of being put in a position where they might have to do something about it. You know, do I have to take it on? Do I have to engage with it? Do I have to stand up against it? Or am I reaching too far there? Is that something that concerns people, do you think? Oh, I wouldn't know how to face that. I wouldn't know how to deal with it.
It should concern them, Richie. And it's my honest desire, both as the presenter and the lead consultant on Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. I hope that it gets people, if nothing else, I hope that it gets people to question everything. If people at least question things and research things before they make decisions or take actions in life, rather than just acting like sleepwalking zombies and assuming that because a perceived authority figure has told them something is correct, if they start to ask questions, then they can at least choose to either act on the new information they found, which could contradict what the authority figure says, or they can find out that it contradicts what the authority figure says. But if they want to carry on living in their comfort zone, then of course they've got that choice. But I would hope that a percentage of people will, when they start asking the questions and start researching and see for themselves that things are not as they appear, and that generally speaking, pretty much in every area of life, whether it's politics, education, the workplace, the media, literally every area of life, there are people at the top that have got an agenda of either getting more money, more power, or more control, that are using psychological techniques to manipulate and put people in positions. And so hopefully people will start to do something, because if they do nothing, sadly, it will dangerously stay as it is. And as David Icke, who I have so much respect for David, I've read all his books, I've been to his live all dayers. You know, I booked my ticket for September to go to his book launch in Derby and stuff. As David says, we need, as a society, to start to ask questions, to start to question things, and to start, it sounds dead simplistic and airy-fairy, you know, treat one another as we expect to be treated ourselves. But as David says, there are only really two things in life, two extremes, love and hatred, or we can interpret that as pleasure and pain. But those ends of the spectrum are what are used within brainwashing and psychological manipulation to affect people at an unconscious level. So they feel some level of pain that stops them, the powers that be hope, from questioning things, from moving forward. But what I'm saying is that when you start to question things, initially it may feel painful and uncomfortable because it's something you're not used to doing. But if you break through that pain barrier, it's like sports people talk about having to break through the pain barrier to get into the zone. And once they find their zone, they can then condition themselves and anchor through psychological techniques the ability to be able to enter the zone as a sports person whenever they want to. Well, as human beings, if you break through that pain barrier of facing up to the fact that there is a bigger picture to look at, start questioning things, start researching, and start to question, why do people say, oh, David Icke's a nutter? Or no doubt after this documentary, they'll be saying, those same kinds of people will be saying, Jonathan Ryle's a nutter. Is it because Jonathan Royle is a nutter? Is it because David Icke's a nutter? Or is it because we're actually encouraging people, like your good self does with your show every day, to question things, to look deeper?
Yeah.
And if everyone was to do that, we could end up grouping together as a society in a peaceful rebellion of love and harmony, where we didn't take for granted the things that the powers that be are feeding to people through the mainstream media, the illusion of politics, because it's just an illusion of choice voting. Whoever gets in ends up getting controlled and manipulated by the higher up powers anyway. And maybe then we could become free as human beings.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And you know what? There's all sorts of things going off in my mind there when you're talking. One of them is, I had a conversation with Jim Mars, rest in peace, a few years ago. And Jim threw into the conversation, he used to phone me some afternoons when he was poor, Jim. And he would phone me up. I remember he said to me one day, Jonathan, he said, hey, partner, do you sometimes find, he said, that when you know, just gently say something to somebody about some aspect of, you know, the hidden hand and how we're being conditioned, do you find that they get angry? And I said, yeah, I do. And Jim said, do you know why I think they get, I think they get angry, he said, because on some level that maybe they're not consciously aware of, they know that something, that you're right, and they don't want to be bothered. They don't want to be moved. They don't want to be impositioned. So they get angry. And I said, yeah, you're right. I have noticed with old friends and old schoolmates, old colleagues, that even when I gently say something about 9/11, I might say, for example, do you know that the man given all the money to investigate it, well, he wasn't given all the money, he was only given $3 million, Thomas Keane, as a lawyer, do you know that he wrote a book later on that said the whole thing was a load of bollocks, excuse my language, and that it was set up to fail? And they get angry. They don't want to know. And it's really interesting what you're saying there. Jonathan Royle is our guest. Let's talk about hypnotism for a minute and your own experiences with it. People will say that, oh yeah, I'm suggestible and I could be put under. And other people will say, I know you've had this question a million times, Jonathan, sorry for boring you, but I think it's relevant. Right. And some people say, oh no, I couldn't be put under. Are we all suggestible, all of us?
Of course, right. Everybody's suggestible, it's to what degree. But there are techniques that can be used to make people more suggestible. The thing is, the word hypnosis is just a name for a technique. And sadly, and no disrespect intended here to people in the hypnotherapy or stage hypnosis industry, but sadly, the large amount of hypnotherapists and stage hypnotists frankly don't know what they're doing. And that's, I'm not saying they're dangerous, they can help. The hypnotherapists out there that don't really know what they're doing are still skilled and safe enough to help people overcome their habits, addictions, fears and phobias and such like, and help people change their lives for the better. But they've probably been trained by somebody who honestly believed that there are certain limits on what you can and can't do with hypnosis. So that teacher who taught them, who genuinely believes what they taught, because they too in turn were taught it by somebody else who believed that, will believe that, for example, that you cannot make people say or do things that would contradict the morals or the values. And unfortunately, and that's why I said a large amount of hypnotherapists and stage hypnotists and whatnot are actually not as skilled as they may make out, is because I will categorically go on record and state that with hypnosis, you can make anyone do absolutely anything you want, even if that which you were going to get them to do would totally contradict the morals and values, even if what you intended to do was going to be illegal. I will categorically go on record and state that if people look on my website, for example, magicalguru.com, and click on the television and media page, they'll see a video of me on Channel 5's program, The Gadget Show, from a number of years ago. And The Gadget Show set me the task of getting people to reveal their confidential banking and computer passwords without realizing that they, you know, without unconsciously being aware they told me. And in the majority of cases, I was able to do that in the short period of time that I was given. you'll see me fail on a couple of them as well in the video, but that's because I was literally only given like 15 minutes. If I was given the opportunity to spend a few minutes a day over, say, a few weeks with these people and make it look like I'd casually bumped into them, and engineered situations, then I am confident I could have got 100% success with 100% of the people. And, you know, the powers that be have got the finance and the time to socially engineer situations. So you bump into somebody casually in a coffee shop, have a casual conversation, and then you might bump into them again a few days later. And after several months, you could have been recruited into some secret organization. These are the kinds of brainwashing processes that could be used, and I believe are used, by fundamentalist terrorist organizations to recruit people. It's not done overnight. It's done drip fed over a period of time. And you can get people to kill people. Terrorist organizations are one example. Another example is JFK. Now, the guy alleged to have shot him, obviously we now know with stuff that's come out, it wasn't his gun that shot JFK.
Yeah, he couldn't have done it, yeah.
He couldn't have done it, was just made to look that way. To be certain, someone else did the actual bullet that did the murder, but nonetheless, he was brainwashed. Sirhan,
yeah, that's right, yeah. Bobby Kennedy.
He swears to this day that he doesn't remember certain elements of what happened, or it's all like a dream, and that's consistent with somebody who has been brainwashed, hypnotized, and then maybe even elements of trauma-based mind control, such as that which David talks about in many of his books, David Icke, if anyone didn't fill in the blank.
Yeah. The Manchurian Candidate. We're talking about the Manchurian. We're talking about the Manchurian Candidate here.
Yeah.
The person who is an ordinary person, a law-abiding person, a decent person, but over a period of time, you're saying, Jonathan Ryle is our guest, by the way. I'm going to give you that website again. It's magicalguru.com, magicalguru.com. Very simple. Very well-known, very respected performer is Jonathan, NLP expert, hypnotherapist, comedian. He's on the we're talking today predominantly about Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, which is a feature-length documentary coming out in a few weeks' time. Go to extremedangerextremehypnosis.com. By the way, for more information about that, to see the trailer and to read more about it. Now we're talking about something which is fascinating, because I have heard, I went to see a guy called Paul Golden many years ago. I think I saw another.
Oh, great hypnotist. You know Paul? One of the old guys from Ireland, yeah.
Yeah, Paul, yeah, he was gas. I mean, it was an amazing show. I'll tell you how innocent we were, Jonathan, I'll just make you laugh. I'll tell you how innocent we were. My friend Marty and myself went along to see it. We were 15. And when we got there, Paul had this big gigantic eye on the stage. So immediately when the audience came into the room, every one of us was knocked out of our comfort zone, because we thought the eye was doing something to us, right? All of us. And halfway through the show, Paul said, I bet you thought that eye was doing something to you when you came in. And he said, that's the power of suggestion. He said, a little thing like that, I got you out of your comfort zone. I got you into a different place. And I thought, wow, yeah. But yeah, I saw Paul. And Paul, maybe Paul didn't say it. Maybe I've heard other people say it, that I'll bring you up on stage, you know, we'll play some games or whatever. I'll make you cluck like a chicken, or I'll make you think you're, I don't know, a golden Labrador or whatever. But I couldn't make you do anything that you wouldn't do yourself. And yet you were saying to me clearly and concisely today, Jonathan Ryle, that you, with your skill and talent, could induce somebody to do something heinous. You could do.
Oh, of course. You see, the thing is, stage hypnotists as a whole, they fall into two categories. They fall into the ones that are not very skilled. They're reasonably good at what they do, and I'm not saying they're dangerous, they're safe at what they do, but that's all they do. And they really, frankly, don't know very much about what they're doing. I can say that if anyone's been trained by me, they don't fall into that category, because I do teach my students the simple fact you can get anyone to do anything. And that's the other camp. They're the camp of people who do know what they're on about, But they will blatantly lie to an audience and tell them that they can't make them do things against their will, so the audience feel comfortable enough to volunteer. Because obviously, if you went out on stage and said, look, I can make you do anything against your will, I'm looking for volunteers to take part in this show, how many people are actually going to volunteer? You're going to get a lot less.
Yeah.
Straight away. But, you know, I'm famous. I'm not proud of this, but when I was young, I really did push things to the limit because my one of the guys who taught me, a guy called Delavar, is no longer alive. But when he taught me, he was in his 80s, and that's going back. I started doing stage hypnosis shows in 1990 when I was 15.
Wow.
And I was doing hypnotherapy sessions in 1989 when I was 14. And Delavar, who taught me how to the brain mushing techniques. He taught me and showed me stuff about how the military during the war would use these techniques, for example, to help, you know, the soldiers who'd be on the battlefield. They would give them morphine and stuff to take out in the ration packs, and they'd come back and they'd be addicted. And they'd set up what they called sleep hospitals where people like Delavar would hypnotize the soldiers to put them in a somnambulistic, deep, deep state of hypnosis and leave them asleep literally for a week in a bed. There were nurses there who would ensure that, you know, that they were cleaned up when nature took its course.
You're shitting me, Jonathan. I can't believe I'm hearing this. This is unbelievable. This is mad stuff now. Did the soldiers know they were going to be tranced and left there for a week?
Yeah. This was the way to get them over their addiction.
To heal up. To get over their addiction and to heal up, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, so they'd be hypnotised very, very, very deeply. There'd be nurses there who would obviously clean them up when nature took its course in all directions, as happens with cold turkey. But thanks to being in a hypnotised, almost zombie-like state, you know, kind of at the end of the week, they'd be brought round. They'd have already been cleaned up, so they would have their dignity as well when they came round, and they would no longer have any physical cravings for the drug. And also, because towards the end and during the week, people like Delavar would go in and, while they were in this hypnotized state, give them psychological suggestions, the psychological element of dependency would also have been overcome. Because there's not just the physical addiction, there's a psychological and emotional addiction that would have been built up, and all of that would be completely overcome by the end of the week, so they could carry on with the life okay.
Wow, Jonathan. Is there, if I ask a question that you think is offensive or stupid, just say, Richie, that's stupid. But let me ask you this. Is there a super soldier element to hypnotherapy? Can soldiers be created? Because we hear all this thing about super soldiers in the future.
Yeah, it's not a stupid question. Of course they can, and it's not something new. It's not something I claim to have invented. There's a book by George Estabrooks from around the 50s, 60s called Hypnosis. Called Hypnotism even. Now, the book was withdrawn from sale after a few weeks and then reissued with a chapter removed. And that chapter that got removed was called Hypnosis in Warfare.
Right.
And in there, it does tell you how to create a totally mind-controlled hypnotic assassin. And it does tell you how to, for example, be able to find somebody and get them to compartmentalize the brain with or without the need for trauma-based mind control techniques, to be able to act as a spy who could photographically remember everything but then shut it off into a part of their mind so that until their handler said, or the hypnotist gave them a certain key phrase, they would never be able to remember it, so it wouldn't matter if they got interrogated. And those things were already published in that chapter, which then got withdrawn. So there's very few first edition copies available. But when they do, they sell for at least £100 and more on eBay that teach how to do that. And I can tell you from experience, you know, a lot of people in recent years may have seen a program in America with an American hypnotist colleague of mine called Tom Silver. I think that one was called Brainwash, that program. You can look on YouTube, but if you type in Tom Silver Assassin. You'll find stuff on it. And in England, Derren Brown, before that one was done in America, did a show called The Assassin. And the premise of this was that he was going to take somebody and hypnotize them without their knowledge, condition them into committing an assassination.
Wow.
And people write it off as, oh, Derren Brown, Channel 4, he'll have just paid actors and it's all showbiz. I can tell you honestly that Derren Brown's production company originally was a company called Objective Productions. And that production company has purchased over the years practically every DVD training set that I've ever released. And I can categorically tell you, without fear of being sued, that Objective Productions have taken some of the things in the DVD training sets that I sell and used them action for action, word for word, as I teach them within the television programs that they've made and broadcast on television. And I categorically tell you that what Derren Brown did in Assassin can be done.
It can be done. Let me ask you this, Jonathan. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Of all the mass shootings in recent times, the one, I shouldn't say fascinated, because it makes me sound cold and kind of obtuse, and I'm not. Mm-hmm. It does scare me when I see, you know, somebody going into a room and killing people. It does affect me. You know, I'm not going to virtue signal here. I know that in a couple of days' time, we kind of move on. We think about something else. But it does affect me. The James Holmes shooting in Colorado in 2012 in Aurora, that one really, really sticks with me, because a number of conspiracy researchers, and some of them wind me up because they leap to conclusions without having any evidence, but some of them early on were saying, look at the behaviour of James Egan Holmes when he's first arraigned. When we first see him in the room, he looks like a guy who hasn't the slightest idea what he's doing there. And I've often wondered about him, this kid who ran into the cinema, used tear gas grenades and had semi-automatic weapons and shot a load of people. It was a movie theater in Aurora. And there are pictures of him even. I know, look, I'm not even not an expert. I'm a moron. I don't know anything about this. This is why it's lovely having you on. I know nothing about it. But he looks like a guy to me that's in a bit of a daze. I know you could argue, you could say, oh, well, he's very nervous. He's starting to realise just what he's done. But to me, he looks like a guy who hasn't a clue what's going on.
Well, there could be the fact, you know, I don't know for a fact. Nobody, well, I'm saying nobody does. I'm sure there are people, powers that be, that probably do know. But
yeah.
It could, was he on drugs, medication?
Yeah. Antipsychotic medication. So I've got to own up. Yes, I think he was taking antipsychotic medication, the lad.
You see, that can make you look spaced out and stuff. Now, it is possible that when somebody's hypnotized and to do something that they can look as low, they're almost zombified. However, I would argue that a truly skilled hypnotist who also knew the, shall we say, the black art side of things, because it goes beyond just putting somebody into a relaxed state and giving them a suggestion to do something. There's far more involved, using coercion of the mind, visual imagery and painful memories, things I won't go into, because it could be dangerous if people were just to go and try it, frankly. But if it's done properly, I would argue that the skilled hypnotist, if their agenda, they were working within an organization such as that many years ago of MK Ultra, which incidentally George Estabrooks, the hypnotist I mentioned earlier who wrote that book, was involved with their experiments. If this was going to happen on a public stage, and in this day and age, obviously everything's caught on CCTV camera and whatnot, I would say you would observe the person, how they acted normally, and ensure that within your programming, you got them to believe they were doing something that to them would appear to be normal to them to
do. Right.
So that they, in their mind, would think they were doing something normal, but they would believe they were actually doing that. I'll give you a very basic example. if you were to hypnotize somebody without deepening and psychological coercion techniques of the nature that I'm not going to discuss on air because they're that dangerous, and were to say to them, when you wake up in a few moments' time, you're going to pick up the gun on the table in front of you, walk into the next room, shoot somebody dead three times, you know, bang, 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 the likelihood is they wouldn't do it, you know, because the resistance would kick in, the critical faculty, they'd see the gun, it'd look real, and they'd think, no, this is ridiculous. However, if you found out what games that person liked playing maybe when they were a six-year-old,
right,
and it came out that they liked playing cowboys and Indians and they liked to be the cowboy that shot the big chief Indian, you could take that and regress them back in their mind to the idea of that in a few moments' time, when he awaken you, it'll be almost as if you're 6 years of age again and you're playing a game of cowboys and Indians. When you wake up, you'll see on the table in front of you your cap gun, which you'll pick up. And when you walk into the next room, you'll see the big, bad chief Indian, and you really want to win that game of cowboys and Indians today. So you'll fire that cap gun three times to make sure that you've won that game entirely. Then what they would be doing would be something that would be totally within their morals and their values, within their belief system, would feel good to them, in fact, because they'd want to win that game. They'd have an incentive to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and not compromising, as you said, their integrity and their morals. Jonathan Royal is our guest, magicalguru.com. We're going to come back to talk in a second about Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, the feature-length documentary, which will be released in a few weeks' time in very early September, which talks about how the public, how we are being mind-controlled and hypnotized on a daily basis. And Jonathan is talking about some of these techniques and how they are employed in a one-to-one situation. But these techniques are used against the public and populations and nations. We'll come back to that in a minute. Very quick question. You mentioned David earlier on. David tells a story sometimes. And I remember he got into it with me one night over a glass of wine about the hypnotherapist who hypnotizes somebody and gets them to see through a person and see a sign or a piece of paper that's actually behind a person. I've said that all very badly. So somebody is in a trance. There is somebody standing directly in front of them. And then behind the person who is standing in front of them, somebody holds up a note or a piece of paper or something, and the hypnotist is able to suggest to the subject that the person in front of them is not really there and they're able to see what is behind his back. Is that real, or is that just something that somebody told David and David just believed and he shouldn't have believed it?
With the absolute greatest of respect to David, that is one of those things that he has clearly never witnessed have take place. If David hears this and he has physically witnessed that happen in front of him, I'd love him to contact me, because I'd love to know which hypnotist did that for him, and then get them to do it under test conditions, because there's ways you could fake that quite easily, magic trick ways. However, to do it, I've tried it, didn't work. And it's in a very, very old book on hypnotism, mesmerism, from about the 1800s, this story is first in print. And then other people have related it in other books and lectures, as almost saying as though they witnessed it.
Yeah,
it's one of those folklore things.
David tells it in the first person. I'm not suggesting for a minute that he's lying. I don't think he is. He just tells the story in the first person, I think because he believes it.
I'm sure he believes it, but I don't believe, no disrespect to David, but I'm sure he's just written it that way because it reads better. I don't believe for one minute he's witnessed that take place, because I've not met anyone to this day who has. And when the button under pressure, it comes down to they were told that somebody had witnessed it, or they'd read it in a book where that person who'd written the book said they had witnessed it. And the truth is, it all traces back to a book on, as I say, on what hypnotism used to be called before it was called hypnotism, on mesmerism from the 1800s. And that's a fallacy. It's an old trick that conjurers used to be able to do, because what you can do is, you as the hypnotist know what the person has written down that's holding behind the person's back. So all you need is, for example, something that magicians have, a device called a thumb writer, which is a device that enables you to write on a piece of paper without people realizing that you've written on it, or to have a little pen in your pocket that nobody sees. So you can write on a piece of card in your pocket, and then you can palm that card, hide it in your hand, so that everyone else in the room is unaware that that's there, but it's hidden in the palm of your hand with the word on that maybe the person has written down that stood behind the person in the example you gave. And then all you need to be able to do is wave your hand apparently in front of the hypnotized person's eyes as you say you're drifting down deeper. But the thing is, if you were to, say, pinch the skin on the back of their neck slightly, the will instantly react by opening their eyes.
Right.
They won't snap out of hypnosis, but even if they did, as you say deeper, you say sleep, and they would go back and close their eyes again. But in that split second, they would see, hidden in the palm of your hand, the word.
Right, but tell you what, Jonathan, this is great stuff. Jonathan Royal is our guest, and we're going to... I want to talk the last 10, 15 minutes we have left about the film. I'm glad we talked about these things. It's only been a few weeks back that Richard was on. Richard Willett and Danny Cotton have made this film that I can't wait to sit down and watch. Brick in the Wall Media. It's called Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. Jonathan has presented it for them. And it talks about how we, the public, are being mind controlled and hypnotized on a daily basis. The techniques being used by the elite or the Illuminati to reach the subconscious of large populations of people have probably been around a long time. Is it getting, and I should ask you that, I shouldn't assume knowledge, is it getting easier for them? Has screen technology, like tablets and mobile phones, is that making, I know it sounds like an obvious question, but is the technology itself, the glass, the seductiveness of the metal case, the actual physical thing, are the screens, the tablets, the smartphones, making it easier to reach people subconsciously, to make people suggestible? Or is that just another dumb question?
No, I mean, there's two elements to that. There's the element that, yes, of course, people now mess around on the phones and the tablets. So that's become like the portable television set.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why they call them television programs, because they do program you. Because when you're focused on something to the exclusion of the other stuff around you, you naturally go into a theta state, which is the state of hypnosis, but you've got your eyes open. That is why I say in the documentary that there's no such thing actually as hypnotizing somebody, because we're all hypnotized 24 hours a day. It's just a case of what trance are you in? Are you in the I'm going to work trance, or are you in the I'm now a father family with the family trance, or are you in the I'm at work trance state of mind? All it is when you apparently hypnotize somebody, all you're doing is hijacking the state of mind they're already in and manipulating it, steering it in the direction that
you wanted to go.
Yeah, exactly. Now, a hypnotherapist does that with positive intent to help people overcome habits, addictions, fears, phobias. A stage hypnotist does it to get people to remove all their inhibitions and do the most ridiculous of things. The powers that be will do it so that you become scared of stepping outside of the box, so that you are more likely not to ask questions and question things, which is what we hope the documentary will encourage people to do, so that it puts you into that free state. People talk about fight and flight a lot, but there is the middle state as well, called freeze. So, you know, you confront a dinosaur in caveman days, and before people write into the Richie Allen Show saying there weren't dinosaurs in caveman days, I know, but it's just an easy way to give this example. The caveman confronts dinosaur and he either fights to kill dinosaur or get killed, but if he manages to kill the dinosaur, he's got a nice supply of food, or he goes, oh, bloody hell, I'm too scared of that dinosaur, and he flights. He runs for the clappers to try and escape. Or his brain goes, what shall I do? Shall I try and fight the dinosaur? I might get killed, but there again, I could end up with a load of food. Or shall I run? I might be able to get away. What shall I do, that one or that one? And he can end up being so confused and disorientated and stuck into that pattern of thought and fear that he literally becomes frozen and it's too late, he'll end up killed. But in everyday life, where there isn't a dinosaur, or rather the dinosaur's been replaced by control of the powers that be and the stresses of
life, bills,
everyday
everything.
Life.
Yeah, yeah.
You can get into that free state of, should I do this or should I do that? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. And then you're in that confused, disorientated state of fear and freeze, that through fear and disorientation and stress flicks you also into the theta state of hypnosis, where you're more manipulable, because people think you've got to be relaxed to be hypnotized. No, you can be in that theta hypnotized suggestible state through fear. You can be through extreme joy. You know, at the moment of orgasm,
sometimes
male orgasm,
yeah.
Or female orgasm,
yeah.
You as a human being immediately in that moment are probably the most suggestible you could ever be.
Wow, is that right?
And that is why often in trauma-based mind control, there will be sexual abuse involved, because even though people are forced into sexual encounters against their will and it's traumatic and abhorrent, that doesn't stop automatic physical orgasm response occurring at some point. And the powers that be know that in that very moment, that very second, that very instant is the most suggestible and manipulable somebody can actually be.
We've had over the years the experience of meeting people like Kathy O'Brien. I think Kathy is a very credible woman. My rule of thumb has always been, since I left mainstream media, if my guest believes what it is that he or she is saying, I'm delighted to have them on the programme. And I don't care then what the audience thinks. Not because I disregard my audience, but I trust my audience to be adult enough to make their own mind up.
And do their own research.
And do their own research. Exactly, Jonathan. Well said. And I like Kathy. So these programmes, these MK Ultra programmes, they're real then, these programmes. And they have targeted people, maybe many people, over the years to get people to do things.
I 100% truly believe that, well, there's no reason to not believe that MK Ultra programs at the very least were real and took place, because there are declassified CIA documents that confirm the MK Ultra Project Paperclip, Project Bluebird, and all the other derivatives definitely did take place, and elements of that involved hypnosis experiments with the likes of George Estabrook, and also the use of hypnotic techniques combined with certain drugs. That's actually fact. If people choose to go and look, you know, even declassified documents show that. But if that is provable through declassified documents, imagine what happened that isn't declassified.
Yeah, that's right. The stuff they don't tell you.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because you're right to point out the information is in the public domain, but still, when some of my old colleagues get in touch with me and they patronise me, they tell me, oh, it's great, it's a great laugh, Rich, you listen to your programme. There's a way to insult you. You know, and I, of course, I laugh it off because I've got very thick skin. They're like, oh, it's funny and all that. And I'm like, well, the documents are there, particularly about MK Ultra, and they will always come back with something like, ah, yeah, just because they tried to do some of that mad shit doesn't mean that they managed it. That's what you were talking about way at the beginning of this. The cognitive dissonance is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, oh, they tried to, but it doesn't mean diddly squat. Well, maybe it did mean diddly squat.
The proof is, right, the proof is around in everyday life. The simple fact is, 99.9% recurring of all Muslim people are wonderful, nice, honest, genuine, sincere people who mean nobody in any way, shape or form any harm. Simple as. You always get a rogue somebody in every race, colour, creed, religion and society, including our own. That also is a true fact that nobody can really argue with. So with that taken as fact, the fact the majority of people are good, don't mean anyone any harm and just want to get on with their own lives peacefully, The simple fact is, pure logic tells you, you don't suddenly wake up one day and go, you know what? I'm going to volunteer to blow myself up. No, that person has to have been brainwashed, conditioned, programmed over a period of time into ending up believing some ridiculous, that if you heard it, you know, in one sentence would seem ridiculous, but drip for Fred and cleverly manipulated so that pain and pleasure manipulation is used so it seems rational. A belief system is instilled, so they end up believing that it's a logical, rational, positive, and beneficial thing to go and blow themselves up and cause loads of innocent people, well, innocent to us and the mass populace people to die. But by that point, sadly, they would have been brainwashed and manipulated and programmed and controlled into the idea that, you know, the people that were getting killed weren't innocent. That doesn't just happen. It takes time. It takes techniques. These techniques got developed somewhere. And, you know, it's not a massive jump to think that the powers that be, for whatever reason, some of them may have let these techniques leak out that were learned through MKUltra. To other sides, because, you know, what's the difference between that and the fact that, you know, one, America funded both sides of the world wars. America have supplied weapons to both sides of wars in the past. That's provable fact. That's not much different than arming people with the techniques to brainwash, control, manipulate.
You know, listening to that, I'm mindful of the memoirs of Hemphor, the spy who wrote a document claiming that he introduced Wahhabism to the Middle East. He introduced the ultra-conservative and violent interpretation of Islam. And some people say today that it's a load of nonsense. We're talking about the early 18th century here now, the early 1700s. And I wonder if it's true that Hemphor and British intelligence introduced Wahhabism for reasons to divide and conquer. Did they use some of the techniques that you've been describing, Jonathan? Why not? Like, it's a possibility, you know, it's out there, to get people to do these extremely anti-human, you know, that would go against the grain of every fibre of your being. Maybe they did have these techniques back in the 1700s and the 18th century, maybe. Amazing stuff, this.
I think, you know, from the dawn of man, once man became able to speak, think and stuff, you know, hypnosis is a technique, definitely goes back to Egyptian sleep temples. There's wall paintings of people in what looks like a sleep-like state in pyramid temples, but with images of like God speaking to them. Now, I'm not going to get into the whole debate of maybe, possibly, you know, aliens from another planet and all that kind of thing and the gods as aliens debate. I keep it dead simple and say it was other Egyptians.
Right,
that
okay.
Used the fact that there's a great echo in pyramids if they're built right. They become like an echo chamber, and an echo can be very resonant and very hypnotic sounding. That's why churches, when people speak, the minister, it echoes. Yeah. It has a very hypnotic effect.
Yeah, and you love listening to it. You get very comfortable listening to it.
Yeah, it relaxes. Yeah. And they had sleep temples in Egyptian times where people were... It was, I don't know, but perhaps the equivalent of what we call stress now, but it made them feel good. Okay. If they were aware of that, then I'm sure that, you know, as soon as somebody was able to work out something can be used for good intentions and affect somebody in a positive way, it's human nature that somebody out there who's already got nasty streaks within them
no doubt.
Is going to work out a way to manipulate it and use it negatively.
Jonathan, when I say I could speak to you all night, I mean it. I wouldn't dream of patronising you. Do me a favour. First of all, good luck with the film. It's
thank you.
Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. Richard Willett and Danny Cotton, the filmmakers. Jonathan Ryle, the hypnotherapist, the NLP expert, the mentalist. Jonathan fronts it up. He presents it. I can't wait to see it. It's out in a few weeks' time. Extreme Danger, ExtremeHypnosis.com. Do buy it. Watch it on demand. Pay for it and watch it. It talks about how elites use the techniques that Jonathan has been describing to manipulate and control people, populations on a daily basis. Listeners have been tweeting me with questions about hypnosis that I know you've heard 500 million times. Regress, you know, life regression and stuff like that. But maybe, maybe you'll come on the show and do 90 minutes with me to talk about some of this stuff as well, because I'd love to have you on, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
I'd be more than happy, yeah.
Jonathan,
I mean,
I should say.
If your listeners want to send you in questions and we arrange a time that, you know, I can have a look at a lot of them in advance and then we can answer them all. Yeah, of course.
That'd be brilliant. Jonathan's own website is magicalguru.com. That's his own website. Check him out there. And it's Extreme Danger, ExtremeHypnosis.com. The film out in September. Richard Willett, Danny Cotton. And it features people like the great Neil Sanders, who's been a regular guest on our programme. Thanks for your time, Jonathan. I've really enjoyed it, mate. You've opened my eyes to a lot of things. I really appreciate that.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and a privilege, Richie.
No, the privilege is mine. Thanks so much. Jonathan Ryle, go to magicalguru.com, folks. Bookmark the site, and it's Extreme Danger, ExtremeHypnosis.com. That's where you'll learn about the film, which is forthcoming, the trailer and all the rest of it. Huge thanks to Richard Willett for putting me on to the film, and to Jonathan. Amazing stuff. That's it for Tuesday's programme. Look after yourselves and one another. We'll do it all again tomorrow, Wednesday, at 5 p.m. UK time. But before that, of course, you and I will do the papers tomorrow morning on YouTube. That's 9:30 on YouTube, the papers. All right. Going to leave you with a bit of Wang Chung, everybody. Wang Chung tonight. This is the other song. A song called Dance Hall Days. Thanks again to Jonathan Ryle and to the brilliant Tony Gosling, thisweek.org.uk, BCFM. I've been Richie Allen. Thanks for listening. I love you. Speak tomorrow. Bye.